Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
Welcome to this OnFit Podcast, looking at the impacts of COVID-19 has had on pushing forward the modernization efforts for governments and corporates, and how this links to furthering the ESG agenda, especially in the Asia-Pacific region. I am joined by Jill Meller, who is MTR Corporation's Legal and Governance Director. This is the public transport company with operations worldwide. And Michael Camerlingo, a partner in Hong Kong for KPMG. He leads the government practice in the Asia-Pacific region and the infrastructure sector for KPMG in Hong Kong. Thank you both for joining us. I want to start by asking, Jill, what was your impression of how the pandemic has affected the sustainability agenda for the corporate world as well as for governments? Michael, I'll come on to you for the same question following Jill's initial thoughts.
Thanks, Ellie. And I think for me, the pandemic has really shone a spotlight on both environmental and social issues. I think environmental issues were already on most corporate agendas. And certainly we had the IPCC report out this week, which described the environmental situation as a kind of code red for humanity. But for me, the pandemic has really focused or encouraged companies to focus on the social agenda. So issues like safety of your workforce, safety of customers, health of your workforce, issues like a living wage, issues like homelessness. And I know lots of cities around the world made efforts to house the homeless during COVID so that they could deal with the pandemic. And so I think it's shone a spotlight on both environmental and social, but I think it's really given companies a wake-up call to think about social objectives and how they can help to contribute to meeting some of those societal needs, while at the same time, obviously, delivering long-term sustainable value for their companies.
Thank you. Michael, what is your perspective from the pandemic in affecting the sustainability agenda?
Thanks, Ellie. And I fully agree with Jill's points there. Just to touch on a couple of them, I think the pandemic has done is really highlighted the level of inequality that exists around the world in our communities. So items such as access to affordable and quality housing, many of us forced indoors for long stretches of time during the pandemic and really emphasized or highlighted those challenges in certain locations. Access to affordable and sustainable energy, access to digital infrastructure that enables work from home and education from home, and of course, access to quality healthcare. And this is even within certain jurisdictions and leading developed cities, we're seeing mixed levels of access across some of these dimensions. So inequality really, really at the top of the agenda there. So I think what these drivers are doing is they're spurring an increase in the volume of corporate organizations wanting to play their part in delivering a more sustainable solution for their stakeholders. They're starting to realize that it's no longer just about the one-dimensional focus on long-term shareholder wealth. It's about delivering a prosperous future to shareholders, of course, but also to wider stakeholder groups that is a bit more multidimensional in nature. So looking at the environment, looking at the community, looking at economic and of course, financial imperatives.
Thank you. I really like the focus on sustainability and ESG, focusing on the governance and also the social elements as well. Obviously, the environment is incredibly important, and we'll go on to that a little bit later, but so is the whole holistic approach. So I think that there are some very pertinent points there. On looking at kind of Hong Kong and the Asia Pacific region, where is this in its sustainability journey, do you think, as a region?
Thanks, Ellie. I think the region is taking this more and more seriously almost every month. I mean, over the last 18 months, we've seen client activity in the region really ramp up around sustainability, and it's good to see. And if I pick some examples, focusing closer to home in Hong Kong, we've seen a lot of initiatives on the environmental side. In particular, the UN Race to Zero campaign has driven a lot of interest, and I think that has partly spurred government here to sign up to carbon neutrality goals by 2050. So that's probably the big policy initiative that we've seen. But we're also seeing some more tactical initiatives, things like a feed-in tariff scheme was implemented in recent times to promote community participation in renewable energy, you know, at the residential level and you know, around solar and wind systems. We're seeing schemes that involve phasing out of diesel commercial vehicles, you know, the emissions side of things. And we're also seeing a greater policy emphasis towards green buildings that are more energy efficient and less carbon intensive. So lots of good initiatives that we're starting to see. I think there's still a lot of room for improvement on the environmental side and also the social side. But these are some of the you know, interesting highlights that we've seen in recent times.
And Jill, do you have anything to add to that?
Yes, I think I'd agree with Michael that there's some good progress being made, particularly on the environmental side. Mm. I think the Hong Kong government's commitment to carbon neutrality by 2050 is a great commitment. The challenge, of course, is how they're going to achieve that. Mm. And for corporates, what role we can each play to try and help achieve that goal. But I do think there is more to do for individuals in Hong Kong in terms of our own lifestyle choices, certainly for corporates and also for government in terms of regulation. And I come back again to the kind of social side where I think corporates are, as Michael mentioned, realising that they have a role to play and actually wanting to play that broader role in society, but perhaps struggling to know kind of where and how to play. To try and, you know, which area of societal needs might you want to try and focus on as a corporate? How do you justify that as being in the corporate interests? And how do you really go about implementing that outside of perhaps setting up, you know, charitable foundations, which we have a lot of in Hong Kong? I think one area where we have made good progress is on the governance side. I think, you know, Hong Kong obviously very important as an international financial centre. And I think we do, led by changes implemented by the Hong Kong Stock Exchange in terms of reporting and the like, I think we have made pretty good progress in terms of driving the sustainability agenda from a corporate governance perspective.
Thank you. And looking beyond the pandemic, what are those factors that are driving the increased focus on ESG and sustainability for corporates in the Hong Kong market, but also the government, as you say? Why do you think that those successes have been a success? It probably came before the pandemic. And what are those driving factors?
We've touched on the environmental side and the climate piece already. So I'll move on to maybe focus more on the community and social piece. I think one of the things that's really impacted Hong Kong in recent years was the social unrest that we experienced in 2019, early 2020. You know, the pandemic has obviously been challenging for all of us around the world, but really time will tell as to whether actually the social unrest has had a bigger impact, and potentially that will be the case. But I think, you know, at the time when that was, you know, a lot of Hong Kong attracted a lot of media as a result, much of that media centered around topics like universal suffrage and global geopolitics, right? But if you ask me, actually there were some other issues that had a role in surfacing some of that social unrest that probably didn't get the same media attention. You know, and I think for me that those issues are primarily around access to housing and wealth inequality. So you know, I think these are challenges that Hong Kong faces, as you know, it is a very wealthy city, but you know, it obviously has disparity from the in terms of the haves and have nots. So I think these are dynamics that aren't something that can be solved overnight. I think they're challenges that are, you know, they're areas of development for Hong Kong, and I know that the government is focused on them and is implementing initiatives already to help address some of these challenges. So I expect to see more emphasis and investment from the government in these areas in the years to come, with a view towards delivering more balance and more sustainability in the community from an equality point of view.
Thank you. And Jill, the same question to you, but perhaps also you could start talking about how this has impacted MTR as well. So kind of bundle that's the thinking around the beyond the pandemic, what factors have drive the increased focus, but also where MTR is and how that has affected MTR's sustainability journey as well.
Of course. So I think for MTR, the imperative really has been twofold. One is demands from a very broad group of stakeholders. So it's anecdotal evidence But apparently graduates these days will first of all look at the recruitment page on a corporate website, but will then go to the sustainability page. And graduates, we know, are expecting to work for or want to work for companies who they believe have the same values as they do. We also, though, at the other end of the spectrum, perhaps have questions from our major investors. And so our largest active investor met with our CEO and finance director last year, and his first question was about our carbon emissions. And so we're just seeing these demands coming in from all of our different stakeholder groups. And I think the second thing for us as well has been to see these issues, and I mean, they're both environment and societal issues, as business risks. So I think, again, the environmental situation as a business risk has been reasonably well understood, with companies thinking about issues like stranded assets. But I think the points Michael made earlier around social inequality, I think increasingly businesses are seeing that an unequal society is not good for them from a corporate perspective, from a growth and a long-term value perspective. So those for me would be the two key drivers.
Thank you. And where is NTR in its ESG sustainability journey?
So NTR is a little bit of a unique company. A previous CEO used to describe us as having two birth certificates, because we are a listed company, so with obligations to deliver financial sustainability, particularly to our minority shareholders, and also government as our major shareholder. But we also have an incredibly strong public service obligation because of our nature as a public transport operator here in Hong Kong. And so in lots of ways, sustainability has been a part of what we do for a long time. We've been producing sustainability reports for a number of years. But I think what sort of changed for us is that in the past, it has been a part of what we do, but our efforts have probably been reasonably scattered throughout the business. And I think now we see it as more of a strategic imperative. And so last year, we undertook a strategic review with our board of directors that set a very clear new direction for us and actually specified social and environmental objectives alongside our financial objectives. And so I think it shifted from just being something that we did to really being a strategic imperative.
And what is the focus of your ESG strategy? So obviously ESG is huge, which we've already touched on, social, governmental, governance and environment. So where is your kind of key spoke strategy, I guess?
We're focusing on three key priority areas, and we've chosen these both because they are very relevant to our business, but also we believe they are societal needs. And going back to who we are as a public transport operator, we believe that we can have the biggest impact on the environment and on society actually through our core business, as opposed to kind of through add-ons. And so the first area we've chosen is to try and reduce our GHG emissions, which I think, you know, every company has to contribute to this drive. The second area is social inclusion. And this is really a recognition that as a public transport operator, our core business is around social inclusion. Pretty much everybody in Hong Kong takes the MTR, from the old to the young, the abled, to people with disabilities, to tourists, to locals. And so we're all about social inclusion. And we look at that from the perspective of accessibility to our network, affordability of fares. We're looking at the diversity and inclusion of our workforce, and also thinking about how we support broader inclusion initiatives in the community. So we have a fantastic Art in MTR program, which tries to bring the community into our stations and really celebrates the diversity of the community. And our third area is what we call advancement and opportunities. And this is a recognition that as we grow as a company, we want to create opportunities for others to grow and thrive as well. And that could be our staff, that could be our supply chain, or it could be, for example, through research and development with local universities or other academic institutions, or through working with startups and new businesses to try and allow them to grow as well. So those are our three key focus areas.
Thank you. I've actually taken the MTR when I was in Hong Kong myself. So it's part of that, part of the tourist while I was working in tourists. So excellent. And what challenges have you faced on this journey so far?
So I think a few. There is a sense from some people that perhaps MTR is sustainable enough. You know, we are a low carbon public transport operator. So kind of why do we need to do more? And I think a second challenge that we face is showing the business case for some of these environmental and social initiatives, particularly again on the social side. and particularly where the benefits to us as a company might be a little bit more intangible. So if we're talking about the benefits being employee engagement or the benefits being an improvement in our social license to operate, it's quite hard to show those in a business case. And so one thing we've actually been working on is an ESG investment framework whereby we can try and make sure we have the right resources allocated to these kind of initiatives, but also try and make sure almost for everything that we do as a company, the environmental and social consequences are being taken into account.
Michael, could you offer a little bit on what is an ESG investment framework from your perspective? And then we'll go into that for a little bit more detail, because I think it's really interesting to make sure that when we do talk about ESG, especially with the environmental and investments focuses, that we are doing so in a way that is not greenwashing. So it's excellent that you've thought about that. So Michael, please do elaborate.
Sure, Ellie, thanks. So I'll start by mentioning that we have been working with Jill and the MTR team over the course of this year with the development of their ESG investment framework. So, you know, if you haven't heard of an ESG investment framework, you naturally might ask, what is it, right? So just to, in summary, it's a framework that guides capital allocation and investment decision making, taking into account a holistic range of sustainability factors. So traditional corporate investment frameworks were focused on one objective, maximizing long-term shareholder wealth, and usually, you know, measured through typical corporate finance tools such as internal rate of return and net present value, et cetera, with an assessment of risk as well. But an ESG investment framework, it considers those financial factors, but it also brings in the elements of social impact, environmental impact, governance, and potentially economic impact as well. So in short, it's multidimensional in nature. And what it doesn't mean is it doesn't mean sacrificing financial returns to invest only in low return projects that might be beneficial to the community. What it does instead is it creates more of a portfolio driven approach that enables investment to go into different initiatives that will bring different benefits. So some projects might be financially motivated, some might be socially motivated, et cetera, and some might bring in a mix. So it offers more flexibility to an organization to deliver on its sustainability ambitions. And what it also does, and this is really where the real power comes in, it helps to foster an organizational culture that goes beyond just thinking about the financial outcomes. And ultimately, you know, if done successfully, leads to a workforce and a workplace that makes decisions, you know, on the basis of sustainability in the widest possible sense. So that's the real ambition, and that's the kind of aim of an ESG investment framework.
And is Jill, is MRT approaching its framework in such a way? Is there a holistic view that is on that path to looking beyond? Not just obviously, you know, profit's very important, but looking beyond that as well to the impact in society. It sounds very much like what you were saying before that is the case. So that's excellent. But how have you applied this framework into those strategies?
Absolutely. So we're still in the process of developing it at the moment. But the idea is that we will set aside a sum of money to fund either environmental, social, governance projects or environmental and social enhancements to business as usual projects. And really importantly, we're trying to tie this investment framework into our key focus areas. So in each of those focus areas I talked about, we're working on setting targets for us to achieve. And then we will try and use the investment framework to say, look, does this initiative, this program, this investment help us achieve those targets? And if it does, then we should use those funds for those investments. And so for us, it's really been a way of kind of tying together our focus areas, allocating funds for those and ensuring, as Michael mentioned, that with every decision really we make as a company, we're thinking about the environmental and social consequences. And an easy example I often use is, you know, let's say we were buying new uniforms. Are we thinking about social inclusion? Are we thinking about whether they're appropriate for different genders, for people of different ethnic or religious backgrounds? Are we thinking about advancement and opportunities? So could we work with local SMEs? Are we thinking about GHG emission reduction? So are we using recycled fabrics? Are we making sure that the uniforms are themselves recyclable? And so really it's trying to, as exactly as Michael mentioned, embed this thinking right within our decision-making processes as a company.
Thank you. What challenges have you had to overcome in developing this framework? Maybe Michael, for you as well, and any points you want to make around the approaching the framework within a practical sense that MRT has taken on as well. MTR. So
you've given me the tricky question. Okay. So just a few thoughts here. I think the people element is critical, right, to start with. Sustainability as an organizational concept is not easy to define. So I would say educating, sharing, debating has been an important part of our experience working with MTR, really valuable, and I think of any organization that's on this journey as well. So getting the right stakeholders on board, helping them to understand the benefits that embracing sustainability will deliver to the community, to the organization, of course, and to employees, I think that's really key, really central to success. I think the other piece is the technical side of this. There is a fairly complicated technical element here. And I've talked about integrating financial, both of us have talked about integrating financial, social, economic, governance and environmental considerations. That does take some deep thinking. If you think about it, just to give you an example, when we talk about social impact and social benefit, an example is a measure of that is social return on investment, or in other words, monetizing the value of social initiatives. This as a methodology, that's not as mature as typical financial investment evaluation measures. So it becomes tricky to compare apples with apples when you're looking at a financial opportunity with a social opportunity at a very basic level. But nevertheless, we've worked with MTR to develop an approach. It's going well in terms of its development. And what it does is it recognizes these differences in these dynamics and gives MTR a bit of a runway to learn and gather data and mature and build sophistication in the way it analyzes social investments versus other initiatives over time by taking into account lessons learned from data from these investment initiatives. So I think we've designed something that we believe is pretty unique, pretty trailblazing, if I can say that. But certainly, it's something that's a journey, and I think we're happy to have been part of helping MTR on that journey.
And Jill, it would be interesting to hear from you what challenges that you've seen, and then also if you could touch on the benefits as well. So that usual question, what are the challenges for bringing in such a framework and embedding this into your company, but then also what are the benefits that you expect to come and kind of overcome these challenges?
Sure. So I think bringing some of my colleagues along on the journey with me has absolutely been a challenge, and reassuring them that this isn't suggesting that we will invest in projects that benefit the environment and society at the cost of financial sustainability. So it's about considering all of these factors together. And I think the second challenge has really been around finding the right indicators to build into this framework, particularly as we touched on the social side. And getting that right balance of qualitative, but where possible, quantitative measures that we can actually track. Because I think if you can show kind of quantitative benefits, it's sometimes easier to tell that story. So I'd say those are probably the two key challenges that we face. And I think the benefits that will come from this framework for me are really twofold. One is having the funds available to pursue our environmental and social objectives, and making sure that those are ring-fenced and are considered in an appropriate way. But the second is really to go back to that idea of embedding our ESG priorities throughout the workforce and into all of our business decisions, because I think that will be the key to success really here is, every time anything we're doing as a business, we're taking into account environmental, social and governance concerns and trying to balance those with our financial sustainability. So if we can get to that point, then that will really be success.
Excellent. As we do draw this really interesting podcast to a close around the practical implementation of an ESG strategy in a corporate and how that links with the government's own agenda as well, and the real focus on modernization within both the environmental and the governance and social aspects of how a company operates, I'd like to turn to you, Michael, to talk about the future. So what does the future look like for infrastructure, transport, the real estate organizations when it comes to ESG? How can they be really driving this kind of the agenda for the 2050 net zero program?
Yeah. Thanks, Ellie. And you know, obviously MTR operates in all of those subsectors, so I'd also be keen to hear Jill's views. But you know, just to start with, I think infrastructure, real estate, transport, construction, you know, these are industries that are, you know, they're principally focused on delivering benefits to society, you know, benefits to the community, and that's going to continue to be the case. But these industries or sectors are also arguably the largest contributors to greenhouse gas emissions globally, or some of at least anyway. So for me, the focus has to be on how these companies in these sectors can continue to deliver and grow the level of socioeconomic benefit that they provide, but in a way that reduces the impact to the environment and plays a role in limiting, you know, the negative consequences of climate change. So to give you a few examples, on the construction, I think, you know, there's a responsibility on the industry to move towards greener forms of built assets. So reduce levels of embedded carbon, in construction materials. I think increasing use of offsite design and manufacture of built components. Reducing site waste and of course safety incidents, has to be paramount. And I think digital design is another means to help us, you know, move the needle forward further. On the energy usage side, certainly greater use of renewable energy, both in the construction of built assets, and that's something that doesn't happen a lot yet, but also in the operation of those assets as a source of power. I think mobility as well is another area, you know, moving towards more sustainable sources of energy for mobility. One area that I'm really excited by is the potential of hydrogen as a fuel source, particularly as the technological and financial viability of hydrogen as a solution matures in the coming years. To pick up on a couple of other areas, I think asset management. So, you know, infrastructure and real estate that is designed with the end use in mind in terms of energy efficiency and sustainability, increasing that emphasis, and also retrofitting of existing assets. We have a huge built asset environment in Hong Kong, in any city. So I think, you know, organizations that focus on that retrofitting piece. And just to wrap this all together, green finance as well. I think, you know, greater demand for green finance will come as we have stronger standards that actually define better what a green project, a green built asset is. I think we've still got a bit of room for improvement on that. So I think that's going to be a big feature that influences these industries in the future for good.
Thank you. Jill, do you have anything to add to the points that Michael have said around the future?
So, I mean, a couple of sort of MTR examples perhaps that would fit very well, I think, with the issues Michael touched on. So for MTR at the moment, we are doing a decarbonisation study looking at both our rail operations and our property businesses to try and see what targets we can set for ourselves. Can they be science-based targets, and when can we commit corporately to achieving carbon neutrality? There's obviously going to be a price tag attached to that, but absolutely, I think that's something we should be aiming for. But I think Michael's comment on the construction industry is really important. So at the minute, our decarbonisation study is focusing on our operational side, but I think there's a lot that can be done in terms of embedded carbon during construction. And we're talking to government at the moment about a new round of railway projects, and very excitingly, we've managed to design a zero carbon station. Now, that is zero carbon from an ops perspective. Yes. But that's kind of the way that we are thinking going forward, is really embedding ENS thinking in the design and construction phase as well as in operations. So I do think there's a lot more to do, but I think it's an exciting space. I was reading the other day about the concrete industry, how much money is being invested at the moment in startups in the concrete industry to try and think about ways to take carbon out of the environment. So injecting carbon into concrete, yes. Which actually strengthens the concrete and also has the benefit of taking carbon out of the atmosphere. So I think, you know, a lot of opportunities in this space.
it's really good to hear about that innovation. I think that's quite exciting. I want to end with the final question to you, Jill, about what more can be done to drive the step change in ESG performance in the industry, but also maybe more with governments and individuals as well, just to bring us full circle to that, to those conversations we had at the start.
Absolutely. So I think from a government perspective, obviously regulation, but I think also reporting, particularly for listed companies. And there are challenges obviously around ESG reporting in terms of harmonisation of standards. You know, how can investors compare companies who have very different material, environmental and social issues? But I think there is more that can be done there, because just that requirement for reporting makes the company think about what it's doing that it then has to report on. So I think that's really from the sort of government and regulatory angle. From the individual perspective, I think obviously we can all look at our own lifestyles, and I think corporates have a role to play in terms of perhaps educating the workforce around the steps that they might be able to take around transforming the way they live and the way they travel around in order to play their role. And I think for corporates, for me, it's really ESG leadership. I think it's CEOs, directors going out there and talking about what their companies are going to do in this space and taking it seriously. I think I heard the other day the term, not greenwashing, but carbon reduction washing. So this idea of people setting these longer term carbon neutral targets, but without any specific plans as to how they're going to get there. And so I think it's really that corporate leadership for me is going to make a big difference in this area.
Thank you. And thank you both for joining us. Michael, do you have any final words on that driving step change in ESG performance?
Yeah, I think just a final comment would be, I think, you know, with more organisations taking a big step forward like MTR is doing, I think it demonstrates leadership that for other corporations to follow, creating a bit of a virtuous circle. So this is not something that needs to be, you know, organisations should be hiding. They should be actually proud of it and sharing it. And that's partly why we wanted to have a chat today and share, because this is for the benefit of all, right? If MTR's going in this direction, others in Hong Kong will follow and elsewhere. So I think that's a real positive, and looking forward to seeing more organisations follow suit in the coming months and years.
Excellent. Thank you. I like the idea of the virtuous circle. So hopefully we can do that. But I'm also think it's very important what Jill was saying. And something that we look at OMFIF as well is around those reporting standards, around making sure that there are targets set that are sensible, that and embedding into your current work streams those targets as well. So the investment strategy and the ESG strategy, I think, is key to making sure that we do try and hit those targets that we really desperately need to, looking at the climate agenda. And also the governance and the agenda, looking at the inequality as well, as I think an incredibly important part of that that can't be lost. So thank you very much both for joining, and thank you all for listening to this OMFIF podcast. Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe to our upcoming event on revolutionising the financial sector to achieve net zero, which is taking place the 29th and 30th of September over 2 days, and includes over 14 central banks, 4 governors, and many other fantastic speakers. To register, please visit our website.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OMFIF podcast.